We'll hear argument now in number 917580, Gary Graham versus James A. Collins. Mr. Tiger.
Mr. Chief Justice of the United States, and may it please the court, Gary Graham was 17 years old and the product of a profoundly troubled family background when he struggled with, shot and killed Bobby Grant Lambert in the supermarket parking lot. His case and the issues presented today must be resolved, we suggest, by reference to precedent, experience, and tradition. Precedent, in the guise of Lockett and Eddings, yes, and Stanford versus Kentucky, in which the court has repeated over and over again the powerful mitigating force of youth. And yes, precedent in the sense of Penry versus Lynow, because this case, we submit, is stronger for us than Penry's was for him because of the role of youth in this court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence and because of the presence here, as in Eddings, of the potentiating force of the family background coupled with the evidence of youth. And it is weaker for the respondent than their position was in Penry, not simply because Penry has, in the interim, been decided, not simply because the prosecutor here, as in Penry, sought to make the second Texas special issue into a double-edged sword by arguing that the condition, in fact, made the defendant more dangerous. But also because, in this case, the trial judge told the jury over and over again in voir dire or voir dire, whatever one prefers, that they were to consider the special issue language in ways that cabined, confined, and constricted those special issues. Cabined and confined them so there was no chance that the promise of Jurek could be redeemed. Jurek was premised on a promise. The court said that it appeared the state that the jury could consider certain things. And the court said that right after a paragraph in which it enumerated age as among the things it thought of constitutional significance. That's the promise that has not been redeemed. That is why Judge Higginbotham in the court below said that this case is governed by precedent. So I turn to the issues that the jury had before it, those special issues 1 and 2, because those are the significant ones. Special issue number 1 has to do with deliberateness, and yet the trial judge told the jury that that meant nothing more than intentionality. That is to say, the same element of the offense of which Gary Graham then stood convicted, because that's the element under 6.02a of the Texas Penal Code that is a part of first-degree murder. Special issue 2, future dangerousness. Here is in Penry, both double-edged and under-inclusive. It's double-edged because Gary Graham was 17. He had a longer time before he got old enough to outgrow the kinds of behavior the trial judge said satisfied future dangerousness. Doing wheelies with your Harley on a lawn, pouring paint on a car, those sorts of relatively trivial offenses. Double-edged because there is in this court's cases a deep and, we say, rationally based social consensus that youth is mitigating in and of itself. That is to say that it's mitigating beyond what it may have in terms of predictive ability. The prosecutor emphasized the double-edged point by saying, as the seed is planted, so grows the sprout. The twig is bent, so grows the tree.
If we accept that, do we have to overrule Jurek? Because Jurek was premised on the fact that that the moral significance could theoretically at least be considered within the framework of the questions, and I'm not sure that the youth consideration could meet the test as you describe it unless we overrule Jurek.
No, Justice Souter, we do not ask you to overrule Jurek any more than the state asks you to overrule Penry. No. Penry said there would have to be an additional instruction beyond the special issue. And all Jurek says is that the jury may be asked to consider whatever evidence of mitigating circumstances. Jurek didn't say that it had to be within the special issues, and the problem, Justice Souter, is created by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which in Black versus State says, we will not retreat a millimeter back from the language of the special issues. We won't authorize giving any extra instructions. It's futile to ask for them. So No, we don't think that Jurek should be overruled. And in fact, the court's opinion in Franklin stands as a testament that under certain circumstances, perhaps many, Jurek and this, what this court said in Jurek, what it said in later cases, can live quite happily together without questioning Jurek.
Well, it seems, Mr. Tiger, that in almost any case, there's going to be some evidence of a troubled background, of positive character traits. So I'm not sure where the limits of your rule are, and I have the same concerns as Justice Souter does. It seems to me that in order to rule for you, we have to overrule not Jurek, certainly Franklin.
Justice
and
Kennedy,
probably both.
At the margin, there are surely cases in which these issues are raised. For example, in Boyd versus California or Franklin itself. This is a case of a 17-year-old whose mother was in and out of mental hospitals 20 or 30 times. So I look to Eddings, which is the closest case, and see if maybe there's an opinion for the majority of the court that answers your question. And I think it does. The court there identified two things. First, factors. The Eighth Amendment mandates that certain factors shall be considered as mitigating. And youth is surely among them if we take Stanford. A troubled family background surely is among them. Then the question is, if the factor has been identified, what evidence? The Eighth Amendment also mandates that the defendant be able to put on evidence. Now, surely, once the state has done that job, as it has done in the three statutes that the state, in this case, clings to as good ones, Saffold, Blystone, and Boyd, then we say that there can be a question, the threshold question, as to whether the evidence proffered entitles the defendant to an instruction that as whether the evidence goes to or sufficiently relates to one of the constitutionally identified mitigating factors. That's a common question in all kinds of criminal cases in those not involving the Eighth Amendment. The court started its opinion in Jacobson, for example, by noting that if the evidence had been different, Jacobson, quote, would not even have been entitled to an instruction. The court's been wrestling with that threshold issue ever since the 19th century, and we suggest that those standards could be applied here. But the third way in this is in which the evidence is under-inclusive is precisely because of Eddings. That very powerful analysis, particularly in footnote 11, about the consensus that adolescents tend to be dangerous, particularly in the teenage years, that there's a sense that it may be society's fault. Not that that's dispositive, or that you or I or any of us would say that it is in a particular case, but that the sentencer, in the words of Eddings, Lockett requires the sentencer to listen. And that comes back to the Jurek point. Henry says you need an additional instruction. That's consistent with Jurek, and why? Because of what the court said in Griffin, which is not a capital punishment case. In Griffin, the court said juror intuition takes care of a lot of problems about what the facts are. But we certainly do not expect juror intuition to be able to deal with what the law is. Their intuition can't save them from the failure of the court to instruct correctly on the law. And another analogy that we draw that we think is powerful is last term's decision in Morgan versus Illinois. If seating one juror who says, I ain't following those mitigating instructions, is an error, how much more of an error is it if the judge says in effect to the jurors, you can't consider the mitigating evidence, which is what was said here, because when the judge had finished with his constricted view of the law, the last thing he said to this jury, before they deliberated the fate of this 17-year-old young man was, you take your law from me. You're the judges of the facts, but you take your law from me. Well, beyond, then, the issue of precedent, seems to us that the Fifth Circuit has missed the Eddings point. Interestingly, the respondent doesn't embrace the Fifth Circuit's opinion. We deal with it in our brief. Seems to us that the Fifth Circuit has mistaken a reweighing of evidence for this constitutional duty under Eddings to look at the factors that are mitigating and to make sure the jury hears about the factors. The second element, if the court please, is experience. And by experience I mean the power that this court has traditionally recognized attaches to evidence of youth. And that runs through many of the cases. Gary Graham was 17 when he killed Bobby Grant Lambert. Nathan Leopold was 18 when he killed his victim. And Gary Graham doesn't say he has the constitutional right to Leopold's result any more than he has the right to an advocate as eloquent as Leopold's advocate. But he does have the right to have his sentencer free to consider the power of this mitigating evidence that this court has repeatedly identified as powerful in the way that this court's decisions teach. The whole life of childhood, said Leopold's counsel, is a dream and an illusion, and whether they take one shape or another depends not upon the dreamy boy, but upon what surrounds him. Evidence that evokes what Justice Powell said for the court in footnote 11 in Eddings. I suggest they want you to forget as justices that which you know as lawyers who have tried and presided over cases, that which you know as men and women, and that the Judge Higginbotham in his dissent identified as the power of this evidence based on his experience as an able trial lawyer and a trial judge before he went on the Court of Appeals. And of course, beyond experience, there is tradition. That's one reason I say that the case is stronger for us than Penry's. The mitigating power of youth is recognized in our legal tradition for at least 2,200 years. And we can trace it back that far. In Stanford versus Kentucky, this court called out the roll call of the states. It began by saying that one sure guide to the Eighth Amendment duty of the court is to look at statutes passed by society's elected representatives. And then the court called out in this roll call 29 states that expressly make youth a mitigating factor. 29. And then, having done that, it's clear from Stanford and from reading the statutes of the other states that if they don't mention youth expressly, that they all have one of these catch-all clauses, catch-all mitigating clauses that the court has sustained in such cases as Boyd and Blystone and Saffel that permit the lawyers to argue it without being headed off at the pass by prosecutorial or judicial argument. Now, in response to these contentions that we make, the state does a number of things. It has some statistics. We didn't bother to answer those in our reply brief because they formed no part of the record below, and we think that the court ought not to consider them, that had they not having been subjected to adversary scrutiny, they don't belong in the case. But it's interesting to note that if you move the age from 23 to 24, that the alleged disparity shrinks to 0.5% instead of whatever they say it is. It's interesting to note that there are 82, not 81 youths that got the life sentence, so their arithmetic is off. It's also interesting to note that if you run the elementary statistical test of the null hypothesis, that the results cannot be attributed to anything more significant than chance. But as I say, I don't think that the court needs to reach that. The question might also arise in the court's decision, well, what should we do about marginal cases? What does age mean? That's in the Court of Appeal. Our contention is this, that age means that at least the teenage years is identified in Eddings. That the Fifth Circuit says 22, the state is willing to say 23, and that time enough to resolve that question because the states are answering it. This is a case of a 17-year-old. And as to 17-year-olds, as to the mitigating force of youth for them, after Penry, Oregon and Texas stood alone. Oregon quickly changed its practice and then its statute. And as we point out in our brief, Texas then amended its statute with the aid of lawyers from the Attorney General's office. Indeed, the reason for that amendment is not hard to find when one reads the stunning concession at page 28 of the Attorney General's brief. That is to say, the statutory terms at issue relate to matters that might support affirmative answers to the special issues, i.e., aggravating factors that have no logical connection to the inquiry as to whether a rational jury could give effect to Graham's mitigating evidence. In short, the state seems to be saying that the factors are probably on their face more adapted to be aggravators, and that additional instructions as required in Penry might be the answer to redeeming the juric promise. That under those circumstances, particularly when you have the instructions in an as-applied way, constricted and confined by the trial judge's instructions and by the prosecutor's argument, there's no chance that the mitigating force of this evidence could have been appreciated by the jury. If we are to go back then to that most objective and reliable indicium, that is to say, what the states have done, it is clear that this is a little like Coker versus Georgia, whereas the court noted in Stanford, Georgia stood alone. Here, Texas stands alone. But within its own house, it is divided against itself, for by its legislative enactment, it has recognized that the mitigating evidence that could not be considered under the former statute must now be given a chance to be heard by the sentence.
You raised two, excuse me, questions, I believe, and one has to do with youth and the other with evidence of positive character traits.
That is correct, Justice O'Connor.
Now, I suppose there isn't a defendant in the world that hasn't patted a dog or kissed a sibling or been kind to a grandmother at some time in their life.
Yes, Justice O'Connor, that's true. We were asking the court to illuminate what it means by the word character in the character and record and then circumstances of the offense language. Character evidence is, of course, is not receivable unless it passes some minimal threshold of relevance. That comes back, we believe, to the factors evidence. Here, the positive character traits must be considered. Again, Eddings, I think, is our best case, because these positive character traits existed despite the troubled family background. That is, I don't think that Hitchcock comes out as it does just because Mr. Hitchcock is a kind uncle. I think Mr. Hitchcock's kind uncleness is important because after a lifetime of adversity, he still manages to do that. And here Mr. Graham loves the Lord, cares for the children that he had, and shows these traits despite what's happened to him. So we say that whatever the threshold is, we meet it. But also, looking to such cases as Boyd, in which the court has quite frankly assessed the relevance of the evidence to a factor already identified, and said that there might be some threshold that somebody would have to meet, that standard or that analysis would permit the court to draw a line. Our view is that wherever the line is drawn, we have to disagree with the Fifth Circuit, because on this record, the combination of circumstances is even more powerful than the Eddings combination, as to which the court said you had to look at it as a whole, and that the sentencer there was not authorized to just focus on youth.
Ask you one question on something you haven't touched on in the course of the argument. You mentioned in your brief that there is perhaps a theoretical flaw, or at least a theoretical inadequacy, in placing great reliance on the second Texas question, the prediction of future dangerousness, because that is basically, by its very nature, it is a predictive inquiry, whereas the judgment which must be expressed consistent with Eddings and Lockett is a moral judgment about the individual and the act. If we accept the view that the second question, the predictive question, is in fact not a moral question, let's say in a utilitarian sense, or a moral inquiry in a utilitarian sense, does it follow from your argument, if we accept it, that there will, for practical purposes, always have to be a Penry kind of catch-all question?
No, it does not, Justice Souter, and I think Franklin is the answer to that. Franklin did not contend that his evidence, however characterized, did more than help the jury answer no to the second question. So that there is a case in which the court said it's adequate. The concession the state makes at page 28 of its brief, however, troubles me as your question troubles me. I suggest to the court that the problem is this, that maybe it's true, and the court could conclude that the second question simply isn't adequate to that purpose. That is, in this calculus of which you speak, it really is an aggravator only, as the state seems to suggest. Then all that would mean, however, is that in order to redeem the promise of Jurek, the state, Court of Criminal Appeals, would have to moderate its language a little bit. And instead of saying things like, "We will never retreat," it would have to pay attention to what this court made the quid pro quo for upholding the statute on its face in Jurek, that
That is to say, to accommodate the statute to circumstances that are presented to it. The state had this opportunity and has repeatedly refused to avail itself of it. There's one reason why the claim couldn't conceivably be procedural defaulted, because it was so clear that of futility. But I hope I've answered your question.
Good enough for now.
Thank you very much.
We pose the questions, we don't answer them.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm sorry, I was trying to get my paper graded, and that was very improper of me to do that. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, if I may.
Very well, Mr. Tiger. Mr. Palmer, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Graham's claim that his jury cannot give mitigating effect to his constitutional evidence is both factually and legally insufficient to establish an Eighth Amendment violation. It fails as a factual matter because many of the assertions on which his legal theory is based are not supported by the record, and it fails as a matter of law under Jurek.
Could you speak up a little bit, Mr. Palmer?
Yes, Your Honor.
I was maybe having a hard time.
I'm sorry. One would think that if Graham's mitigating evidence were as compelling as he suggests, that it would be included in the joint appendix. It is not. The joint appendix consists of 612 pages, 434 of which are devoted to voir dire, a matter that, to my mind at least, does not bear on the question presented. Graham's punishment phase evidence, by contrast, is quite scant. It may be found in the record at volume 20, pages 474 to 86. It occupies 13 pages of the record and would have occupied 7 pages of the joint appendix, yet it is not included. Examination of the record reveals, I believe, the reason for this omission. For instance, Graham tells us that he worked a job to support his two children. The basis for this assertion is 6 lines of hearsay testimony. There's absolutely no competent evidence in the record that Graham was gainfully employed or that he supported his family. In the same vein is Graham's assertion that his 17 years had been characterized by religious devotion. Again, the only basis for this assertion is 4 lines of his grandmother's testimony that he attended church with her between the ages of 3 and 11. She admitted that she had no knowledge of his activities after the age of 11, and there is absolutely no other evidence of his supposedly religious nature. As to Graham's troubled childhood, the only basis for this assertion is 15 lines of testimony from the grandmother. There is no evidence that Graham was mistreated in any way as a child, and there is absolutely no showing that any event of his childhood contributed to make him the extremely violent person he had become at the age of 17. In addition, Graham misconstrues the record of the voir dire examination at his trial. While the judge and counsel for both the state and Graham offered varying definitions of the word deliberately, the trial court did not, in fact, define that word for the veneer members so as to reduce the state's burden of proof. The record shows that the trial court repeatedly advised the veneer members that the term would not be defined at trial and they were to use their own common sense interpretation of what the word deliberately means in answering the first special issue. To support that statement, I would refer the court to the joint appendix at pages 90, 169, 205, 291, 353, and 419. Finally, Graham's assertion that the trial court's definition of the term criminal acts of violence somehow reduced the state's burden of proof on the second special issue is likewise refuted by the record. The examples offered by the trial court of relatively minor offenses were included in a broad definition of that term, which also referred to robbery, rape, and murder. Again, as with the term deliberately, the trial court told the veneer members that criminal acts of violence would not be defined at their trial, and as with the term deliberately, the jurors would use their own common sense interpretation. Not only is Graham's claim factually lacking, it also is untenable as a matter of law under Jurek. In Jurek, this court upheld the constitutionality of the statute at issue here precisely because it allows the jury to consider whatever evidence of mitigating circumstances the defense can bring before it. The jury court did not believe that the special issues were so narrow as to foreclose consideration of mitigating evidence, but instead found that they guided and focused the jury's consideration of the circumstances of the individual offender and his offense. Jurek controls Graham's claim. There is here the defendant was a young person at the time of his offense. Both the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and the Fifth Circuit have held that youth includes defendants up to the age of 23 at the time of their offense. Graham acknowledges, as he must under Jurek, that his jury could give mitigating effect to his youth in answering the second special issue. But he claims that it had relevance outside the scope of the Texas statutory scheme. As the Court of Appeals observed, though, to say that youth cannot be considered under the special issues is necessarily to say that any evidence to which a defendant ascribes mitigating value cannot be considered.
Are you going to get to his specific argument that in this case he was sufficiently young so that when, for purposes of the second question, future dangerousness, the jurors considered that youth, their likely response would be, he is so young that even after conviction, he's still going to remain young, and it's going to be quite some time before he outgrows the impulsiveness, violence, or whatever the case may be. And therefore, considering youth, it really must be considered as an aggravating factor rather than a mitigating one. With the result, unless there is a special Penry kind of circuit breaker here, that there would be no way to consider the youth as a mitigating factor. What is your response to that argument?
My response is, Your Honor, that examination of the trial record reveals that youth was offered for one purpose only, and that was to show that Graham would not be a future danger. Although Graham introduced no evidence of his age at the time of the offense, he was tried 5 months after the offense, and the jury was able to observe his apparent age at the time of trial. In addition, defense counsel stated without objection that Graham had been 17 at the time of the offense. Defense counsel argued that because of his youth, Graham had, and I'm essentially paraphrasing his closing argument, had redeeming value, that he could be rehabilitated, that he would change, would slow down if his life were spared. The record is devoid of any suggestion that Graham wished for his youth to be considered for any other purpose at trial. The trial court was not requested to give the supplemental instruction to which Graham claims he is now entitled. Perhaps most damaging to Graham, rather than whatever aggravating quality might be attached to his youth, is the fact that the state proved that he was a demonstrably violent person, as evidenced by the number of extraneous offenses they introduced at the punishment phase of trial. The state, as recited in our brief, proved up a number of robberies and rapes committed by Graham over a one-week period. In addition, they offered the testimony of a juvenile probation officer that Graham's reputation for being a peaceful and law-abiding citizen was bad. Her testimony obviously supports the inference that prior to this 1 week in May of 1981, he had not been a model citizen. If, however, Your Honor, we accept the definition of youth as given by the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Fifth Circuit, we have to consider it as going all the way up to 23, in which case it falls apart. A 23-year-old defendant cannot make the same argument as Graham can. Indeed, a 17-year-old defendant who is obtains a reversal of his conviction is retried at the age of 24 cannot make that argument. Although Graham acknowledges...
How many cases are there with a death sentence pending now in Texas?
Under this statute, Your Honor?
That fall under this old statute where the argument is made that youth was a factor.
Your Honor, I do not... There are 360 pending cases. I do not... know how many of those trials that argument was made.
There are 360 under the old statute.
There are 360 inmates on death row in Texas who are convicted under the old statute. Although Graham concedes, as he must, that jury remains...
Did the Texas courts, under the old statute, other than perhaps in the Penry case, grant supplemental instructions in any cases?
Your Honor, I am aware that that has been done. I don't think it's been
done. Mr. Tiger represented to us that the Court of Criminal...